it's another Monday, and here we are once again. We've survived another weekend. I assume you survived, Shannon.
Oh, although I tell you what, hard work in the backyard this weekend. Weather was so nice, I did a lot of work done. But and so here's the thing, Bob. I was listening while I was working. I was listening to the Bengals and the Browns on the radio, and then I got thinking: would Bob McCowan rather have, you know, Mayfield or Burrow? Mayfield or Burrow? Because I know you don't like Mayfield.
Well, it's not that I don't like Mayfield. I think Mayfield has severe limitations.
So would you rather have Mayfield or Burrow?
Well, if you'd ask me, here's the honest answer.
They're both first picks overall.
I know.
They've had pedigree.
John, if you'd asked me yesterday morning, if you'd asked me at any time up to 12:59 p.m. yesterday,
I would have said Burrow.
Now I'm cautious.
I would tell you what, when he came out of Oklahoma, I thought he was a cocky bastard.
Well, he was.
I really did. I tell you what, I like him. And I'd play for this guy any day of the week. I'm on his team all the time. I really am. He was focused. You could see it even after the Odell Beckham stuff all week.
Wow.
This guy came to be with his team and lead his team. I was really impressed.
The Beckham thing is an interesting one. And for those that aren't aware, Beckham was given his release by the Browns. And as we talk about this, we don't have a new destination for him. And it may not happen for a couple of days. But there's a sense that he was hurting the club more than helping them. And that this team, they have other wide receivers who are very good.
Landry's so good. Oh, my God.
He really is. Maybe this team is better without him.
I just wanted you on the record that you actually like Burrow more than you like Mayfield.
That's well, it'd be nice, but I haven't gone on that record.
Before the game yesterday,
I would have.
Okay.
I would have been 100% wrong. Look, we want to get to our guest. He's a longtime pal. Spent a lot of time with Alex Anthopoulos when he was in Toronto with the Toronto Blue Jays. A really good guy and not short on words. So we may not have a whole lot of questions for him. He may just talk, but he is now the general manager of the World Series champion Atlanta Braves. AA joins us after these messages. It's McCowan. It's Shannon on the podcast and on Sirius XM. And here's an old friend. He is now a World Series champion. The general manager of the Atlanta Braves, Alex Anthopoulos, is with us. Well, first of all, congratulations. Second of all, how are you feeling? You got COVID, I gather, and you look okay. Did you have symptoms?
Yeah, no, I'm doing great. I really appreciate it. I am fully vaccinated. My wife is as well. My wife throughout this process continues. She has not tested positive at all. So I did a test on Saturday morning. So this is day 10. Probably a good chance I had it Friday or Thursday now. Didn't have any symptoms. And I think that's where being vaccinated obviously came into play. But, you know, it was one of those things that I didn't need to test per MLB rules because I was fully vaccinated. But I would still test from time to time just to make sure my kids are in school and doing activities. And I definitely didn't want to put any of our players or staff at risk. So that Saturday morning, I got a positive test. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was a joke. But then I worked exceptionally hard to make sure it didn't leak. It didn't get out. We were only up 2-1 in the series. And I was very concerned that if I became a topic or distraction, who knows, maybe it impacts us preparing for the game or a player's worried or family members worried. And we had come way too far for me to become a story.
So you didn't have any symptoms at all during this?
No. When I look back now, so we have had games 1 and 2 in Houston. I hadn't been doing media basically the entire playoffs. You know, we get to the World Series. I definitely don't want to do anything during the series. So we had a lot of requests. So the day prior to game one, you know, at the stadium at Minute Maid Park, I just said, I'm just going to do one day of media. I'm going to do them all and be done with it, done for the series. And you know, I believe everyone that was there was vaccinated, but I have to think, like, I did the rounds. I did radio, TV. I was going from set to set to set. And I'm thinking it had to have been there because I was there Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. We flew back. My guess is I would have been positive on Friday if I had done a test. So I had to have gotten it when I made the trip out there. And other than being at the hotel in the ballpark, the only time I was really around people outside our group was that one day, mm-hmm. the off day, the workout, when I did a ton of media.
So you test positive, on the day of game three?
Oh. Yeah, the day of game four.
Game four.
And we were at home. So I could get away with no one really knowing if I'm around or not, because during home games, it's pretty chaotic. It's busy. There's so many people going in and out. And before each game, I would meet with the coaches and the manager. Just we would talk as a group, game planning, strategizing. We walk through scenarios of what could happen during the game. So the manager of the team knew, but I told him, I said, look, last thing he needs is to start getting asked about me and his pregame press and post. And our control person, our owner, my boss, Terry McGurk, knew. But I didn't tell anybody else, obviously my family as well. So I figured I could get by a day or two with anybody realizing I hadn't been around. But once we flew back for game six, people started kind of asking questions. Hey, you know, have you seen Alex? And Freddie Freeman had tried calling me twice. And he had mentioned to someone, hey, I haven't seen him. And, you know, I just did not want to take any chances. I'm glad that we won, because I think before game seven, it would have been out, but I hadn't been around. And again, it's not that I'm playing, but you know, if one player is just, it's on or just being
sure,
just, we have way too much at stake, that I was very, very concerned that it was going to get out. And you know, my whole thing was, even after we won or lost, I was said we're going to put it out. But once we won, I didn't even want to put out during the trophy ceremony, because I don't want to take away from the other guys on the stage. I know that's their moment. I don't want their moment to have an announcement about, you know. So I figured, by the time everybody put two and two together that I was nowhere to be found, everyone will at least have experienced what they were supposed to experience. And at that point, I was just so relieved that we won.
Was this the first time you'd ever watched one of your teams play on television at home?
Yeah, I guess. I'm trying to think. At home, you're right. Probably, you know, because – obviously when the team's on the road, in terms of a home game, yeah, it's the first time. It was kind of nice, to be honest with you. Just having my family, the four of us, watched. The big thing was I got a chance to take part in the parade, and I asked a lot of people that got to do both, what was better, the parade or the on field, the moment that you win. And everyone said that the parade was definitely the highlight. So,
really,
from that standpoint, it was incredible. I mean, just, you don't know what to expect, but just to live through the way everyone's yelling and screaming and the energy and the passion. And you just, you know, we went through downtown Atlanta all the way up to the area that the ballpark is in, called Cobb County. Someone said there may have been 2 million people, but you know, seeing what the Raptors went through, that must have been incredible to experience that and feel that. And, you know, you talk about the highlight of winning, or if you ever need motivation to win, experiencing a parade and connecting with the fan base like that, it's incredible to explain.
So Alex, what's your mindset game five? Your team doesn't play as well, a certain game like Solaire in game six, that was a little different, but what was your mindset in watching the game? You're with your family, but you know, you're a general manager of a baseball team, and not every word is perfect. And do you pace? Do you do everything you did at home?
So, you know, game five, you know, so I miss game, we win game four. I miss game four, we win game four. So, wow, okay, game five, we have a chance to win tonight. So, you know, I'm, you know, which is crazy, but a lot of the day I'm dealing with, what if we win? How are we handling my stuff? There was a scenario where they were going to have me maybe do an interview remotely or something. So, you know, we're talking about if we win. But, you know, we're up 3-1 at that point. So I'm feeling pretty good going into game five. Not that I felt like we were going to win necessarily. I just felt good that we're up 3-1. So, you know, we didn't end up playing well. Things didn't work out for us. We lost. My anxiety and concern was game six, because now you're going back there. You're facing really good starters. You're there at home. We're on the road. We had blown a 3-1 lead to LA the year earlier. So I'd be lying if I didn't tell you I had, you know, those thoughts start to creep into your mind and you start thinking, we've got, we're so close. What if we blow this thing? And you really, I was very concerned about game six because you lose game six, the momentum's all on their side. It's game seven. Here you go. You know, the media is going to start talking about, man, they blew it again. And there's very much in Atlanta prior to this, there's very much a woe is us. We can't have nice things. University of Georgia Bulldogs are king here. It's probably like the equivalent of the Leafs in Toronto. They were in the championship game in 2017. They were up big at the half to Alabama. They blew that game and lost. Obviously, people remember the Atlanta Falcons were up 28-3 at the half.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and they blew that. I mean, all anyone says, that, you know, you just say 28-3 in Atlanta, and everyone knows what you're referring to. So that was going through my mind. You don't want to be associated with that, right? You don't want to be, you know, and again, I've been here 4 years, but, you know, part of when you get these jobs is you want to, you know, change the narrative, right? And you want to, you know, change the vibe of the community and sports town and so on. So I was worried. And I got to tell you, before game six, I was so worried that I told my wife, I think I want to go for a drive. I don't think I could watch just because you can't do anything about it. And I was very worried about the guys we were going to face and so on. And then Freed, first and second, nobody out. You're like, oh man, we might give up some runs here. He got out of it. But I mentioned this in one of my other interviews. I was so worried that I want to take my mind off things. I started to flip the channel. I was looking for anything to watch. And TNT, the NBA was on. I flipped over to the Leaf game for a bit. I mean, not for an extended period, but just to try to just calm my nerves. And I'll do that from time to time, obviously being in the States and being in Atlanta. I'll try to watch, you know, Sportsnet, TSN, whatever I can just to kind of get a connection back and so on. So I watched a little bit of the Leaf game. I watched the Mitch Marner interview after the first. And I would just kind of flip back and forth. And then once we, you know, Soler hit the home run, I watched that. I felt pretty good there. We're up three. I'm still worried. And then once Freeman drove in the sixth run, I told my wife, I said, we're going to win the World Series. It's the first time I was very calm, cool, collected, and just I felt very confident once we were up six that we were going to win that game because our back end bullpen guys were so good and they've thrown so well. I felt very good. Then once we got to the last nine outs with six runs lead, I felt pretty good that we were going to win that game.
With Alex Anthopoulos, I don't need to tell you or tell any fans what you did at the trade deadline this year to change your destiny. And of course, it was reminiscent of what you did in 2015 in some ways, but was it different in some ways? Or was the objective exactly the same because the methodology was slightly different? You got a couple of players at the deadline in 15. You got, what, six or so changes that you made before the deadline this past year. Compare the two if you can.
Yeah, so I talked about this before too. So 2014, I think we had a game lead on the wild card. And again, I'm not blaming anybody. I'm blaming myself. I had spent all my dollars in the offseason, you know, going into 2014. So I, from a payroll standpoint, I was maxed out. And in 2014, we were in a leading the wild card or a game up or tied. And the only deal we made was Danny Valencia because he made the minimum. We didn't actually add any payroll at all. And obviously our players were very upset about it. But at the time, I remember I was trying to make trades and get teams to eat money, but I would have had to trade the time Pilar, Nolan. You know, we used Sean Nolan as the last piece in the Josh Donaldson deal. That was the fourth player. That was the deal. That was what got the deal done. And, you know, Pilar, obviously we liked him and he was a, you know, he's an everyday player for us and very important for the following years. But I thought I was doing the right thing. You know, long-term, I have to manage short-term, long-term. Of course, the players want to win now. But, you know, when I look back and I realize how hard it is to win, how awful it is to go through the last 2 months of the season and you're not contending, and you owe it to the players too. So going into 2015, I didn't spend all my offseason money. I had $7 million left. And I remember at the time, even that winter, we were criticized for not adding more players or not doing more. And, I had kept $7 million in reserve. I thought we were going to have a good team. We had signed Martin as a free agent. We traded for Josh Donaldson. Still had Batista and Encarnacion under control for a while. So I viewed us as still having a chance to go on a run. So 2015, you know, we were again, a game out of the wild card. I know people talked about us being a game under 500, but we are a much better strong team than that. Very similar to what we had in Atlanta. Our run differential in 2015 was fantastic, plus 100 and something, and we ended up, I think, well over 200, plus 200. So we had a really good team. So we were going to make the club better. This whole thought that it was all in and all this stuff, I mean, look, we could have traded Liam Hendricks and Rowdy Tellez along with some other players to get Ben Zobrist from the Oakland A's. And we didn't do it because, you know, I wanted Tellez as a long-term piece. Liam Hendricks was a reliever with long-term control. There was never this thought in my mind of I'm out of here at the end of the year. I was still managing short-term, long-term the entire time. So, but it's just a matter of learning from 2014. When you're close, you better put yourself in a position to add. So we get to the trade deadline here. We had the best run differential in the NL East by a lot. I think the Mets were 9 or 10 games over 500 or 12. We were 3 or 4 under, but we had just underperformed so much. And 2 months into the season, 2 months left in the season is a lot of games. And as long as we could add some players, we already had internal improvements that were going to come. Freeman had gotten off to a slow start. Riley had gotten off to a slow start. Swanson had gotten off to a slow start. Charlie Morton had gotten off to a slow start. So, and we were going to be getting some guys back from injury in the month of August. So it was never a question for me to sell. I know there was a lot of talk about selling and so on. It wasn't even a consideration. Now, did I think we'd win the World Series? No, I just wanted to get in. You know, the thought process was make the club better, give ourselves a chance to win. I also think playing meaningful games into September is important. It's important for your employees, important for your fan base, important for your players. You don't know how things are going to go for 2 months, but, you know, this is my 7th year in a row of being in the playoffs, and I never want to go back. I've lived 5 in a row in Toronto of not being there, and I think back to how did I do it so long? And now that once you get a taste, you don't want to go back. So I think you learn from failing, you learn from making mistakes. And I even said this, I think just before I left Toronto, I felt like I finally started to turn the corner as a GM. I started to put some things together, started to learn some things. Really, it was a big transformation I made internally from, you know, the 2014 offseason going into 2015. I had made some changes internally that committed to do things a certain way. And I haven't changed from that. And I felt like just like a player, you finally start to realize what you need to do and to have some success. It doesn't mean you're guaranteed to have success, but I felt like I finally started to really come into my own as a GM and, you know, going to LA for 2 years helped. And obviously the 4 years in Atlanta has been great, but I learned each year, and even 2021, we won the World Series, but I learned a ton. And even that night, I was the night we won, it was 5 in the morning, and I wrote myself notes in my phone. I titled it in the notes parts, "The Night We Won." And I just wrote down 4 or 5 things, just bullet points, that I felt in that moment in time were really key to us being able to win. You know, and just, I wanted to remind myself down the road, this is what I felt led to winning. And those aren't things I'm going to share, but I just wanted to remember the moment in time, how I felt, and what I felt was key to us finally being able to win the whole thing.
You know, the interesting thing, Alex, is that if you watched your team play through the playoffs and the reaction the teammates have to each other, you would have sworn they played with each other for 6 or 7 years. What's the culture like in Atlanta for baseball then that allows that to happen?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think culture is the most overused word. And I say this with all due respect to any other sports executive, but you know, when people talk about we're going to come in and we're going to change the culture and we're going to do this and we're going to do that, all that sounds great, you know, but I don't personally believe any one executive or person, you can impact culture. Absolutely. Any one person can impact it. But I believe, in my experience, culture is based on, you know, for the most part, the people you bring in, and not one or two, but everybody. So it's not me saying I want our culture to be X. It's going out and getting players that will set the culture for you. If you get a bunch of players that are like-minded and have the values that you want and the things you look for, they are going to make the culture of the club. You can change culture really fast, good and bad. You get a bunch of turds, it'll be crap. You get a bunch of high character, high energy guys. I mean, the one thing you shouldn't get wrong is that piece of it. We can make enough phone calls and do enough work to find out exactly who we're getting and what kind of guy we're getting. And that's part of the change for me. From, I remember talking to Mark Burley at the end of 2014. You know, we had lost. Our last series was against the Orioles. We're playing in Camden Yards. They won the division. Adam Jones is running out in the outfield with a big flag, and they won the division. And I told myself, I'm just going to try this one time to go after high character quality guys, and I'm not going to cut corners. And I remember telling Mark Burley, I'm sick of it. I'm sick of that. We had talented players and talented teams, but we weren't winning. And I said, I'm just going to do this once. I'm going to commit to this once. And we started trading some guys away, bringing some guys in. And I remember Burley sent me a text and he said, man, you were not, this was not a joke to you. You're dead serious about doing this. I said, I am. And throughout the season, even in 2015, there were opportunities to add players that on paper, you would think they're no-brainer adds. They fill holes. They fill needs. Statistically, they're great. You would have taken them in a second. And as a young GM, I would have taken those players in a second. But character-wise and makeup-wise, they weren't what I wanted us to be about. And similar to here, I've become very selective about who we bring into the clubhouse. And there's still moments where I question myself and say, am I too selective? Am I walking away from too much talent? Because, you know, you're not going to have all choir boys, but generally speaking, I mean, we will walk away from players that have a good contract or good club control or statistically perform because there's something we don't like about what we've heard about them as a fit in clubhouse. So I think it's a real thing. I think other players make other players around them a lot better. I know Pat Gillick talked about it. He talks about early in his career, it was 80% talent, 20% makeup, and then it deviated and shifted to 70-30. And I totally agree with him. You know, you need talent, but that other piece I think is exceptionally important, and I think it's a big part of being able to win.
I would say you're old enough to remember this, and I know John and I are. I mean, I used to go to the winter baseball meetings is where the big deals were done. That was, you know, that time of the year was the most important time to build your club. And in my mind, and I think the minds of many other fans, what you did at the trade deadline was just tweaking. You probably couldn't change the outcome based on what you did at the end of July or even at the end of August back then. Given your success now twice, essentially, in really revitalizing baseball teams at the end of July, is that now more important in your mind? Are you going to place greater emphasis on what you're going to be able to do in the season rather than what you can do off season?
I mean, I'd rather not be in that position, right? You'd rather be in a position that you're running away with the division.
Well, of course.
Stacked, right. And, you know, it worked out that way. But, you know, I think the players that you have and the roster you have has to put yourself in that position, right? So, we underperform, you know, we won 88 games, you know, but I think if you look at our expected win totals and so on, you know, our true talent was probably more than 94 wins. Now it happens, bad luck, whatever. We weren't the same team in the last 2 months that we were at the start of the season. And same, you'd say the same thing in Toronto too, right? What we were at the end of 2015 was not what we were at the start of it. We were a much better club.
Of course. So
we were 20 games over 500, I think, right around there, the last 2 months of the season. And then we continue to play as one of the best teams in the game through the postseason. We beat good teams. Brewers, obviously LA, which was big for us. It was the third time in 4 years we had played them and we had lost twice. And obviously beating the Astros as well. And, you know, even back to the whole run differential part, we ended up having the third best run differential in the NL. So yeah, the win total wasn't the same, but behind the Giants in LA, we were third. You know, and they won 107 and 106 games. And I'm not saying we were a 107-win team, but we were, in my mind, a 95-win team that it didn't work out that way. But we were really good by the end of the year, so we felt good going into the playoffs. But I will say this. Billy Beane is the one that really instilled this in me, and it's someone that I consider a friend, and I admire him, and I talk to him quite a bit. But I remember calling him during the summer and just telling him, man, we just can't get on a roll. We're struggling, this and that. And I remember him telling me, he's like, just get to the trade deadline. Just get to the end of July, be around 500. You know, you get to be around 500, a lot of teams are just going to quit. They're just going to bail. They're going to start selling off. There's going to be a bunch of good players. There's going to be a lot of room for you to get better. And he was right. And you know what? As a young GM, I was that team. You know, I was that team that you get to the trade deadline, you peel off and you just quit. And it was a mistake. And I now I've learned the other way. I mean, I do think that the bar in my mind to sell at the trade deadline is going to be exceptionally high, because you're just one, we play every day. People, you know, that live and die with this team every day, the employees, right? There's a sense of pride. Everyone that works for this organization, they identify with it. You know, even though it's a job, they're identified with the Braves. So you're impacting a lot of people when you pull the plug. Now, if you're 20 games under 500, the roster's terrible, your run differential is terrible, yeah, you have to do the right thing and sell and retool. But if you're close and you have a chance, I'm always going to end up going for it. If we're ever close, I'm always going to go for it within reason, obviously, because we still are always trying to manage short term. And even in 2015, I regret not going out and getting Ben Zobrist, but I was trying to manage short term and long term.
If you hadn't had the injuries that you had, would you have been as aggressive at the deadline?
I think it would have been all come down to the same thing. It just, you know, we had injury, we had missed guys. It's where are we positioned? You know, I still believe we would have been aggressive to add, you know? So, and I do think the other change, the other big change is that trade waivers now. You don't have the month of August where you can add guys at the end of August like you could have in the past. So you almost have to stock up. You have to overbuy by the end of July and get just, because, you know, ultimately in 2 months' time, someone's not going to perform. Someone's going to get hurt. You get to the playoffs, someone's going to get hurt. Someone's going to miss time. So you have to go out and actually do more. Whatever you think you need, you should be doing a little bit more, because you need to insulate yourself for performance and injury. And look, we lost Adam Duvall in 2020, at the NLCS game one. You know, he was one of our best bats. He got hurt. He pulled his oblique in the first game. And, you know, we had to put a young kid in the lineup, Christian Pache and so on. But even back then, if I'd been a little more prepared and a little more depth, who knows, maybe we end up winning that series instead of blowing a 3-1 lead. We didn't have the depth that we needed. So that's something that I even learned from 2020 to 21, is making sure we had enough guys, even if guys get hurt in September and even into October.
With Alex Anthopoulos, the general manager of the world champion Atlanta Braves, we'll take a quick break, come back with more after this message. Bob McCowan, it's John Shannon, and Alex Anthopoulos is with us from Atlanta. If you're watching on YouTube or elsewhere, you can see he's perched in his office. Yeah.
Awful view. Just an awful view.
Yeah,
with the slumming it here in Atlanta.
The field behind him.
Alex, I one more question about game six. So you're at home. Who's the first person that calls you when you've when the final out? Who called you?
I got to tell you, so because it wasn't a tight game, I was already getting texts, you know, in the eighth and the ninth, and, you know, not that it's the same thing, but it's, you know, when we clinched the East in Baltimore and Toronto, I think it was the second game of it, or maybe game one of a doubleheader, first or second game, but we were up 8 or 9 runs and your phone starts blowing up. So because we had a 6-run lead and everything was going in that direction, I already started getting texts and congratulations and things like that. So I got to tell you, I don't know that the first person, but there was just so much. But there was a lot of FaceTiming with family and so on. And it's just your phone's exploding, which is a great thing. Mm-hmm. But I think actually the first voicemail I got was probably Paul Beeston at 12:06 a.m. I think when I looked at
really?
The voicemail. And look, I mean, I think you guys obviously knowing Paul and so on. And I didn't know this at the time, but, you know, it's funny that, you know, a week later, I've had more time to let it sink in and so on. And, you know, being the first Canadian GM to win a World Series, I'd heard it at the time. And I don't know that it's sunk in and I appreciated it. But I think now, as days have gone by, I'm more proud of that fact. And I'm more proud of the fact that, you know, we all know how proud Canadian Paul is. And, you know, I haven't had this conversation with him. I've obviously, you know, told him many times how much I appreciate he gave me the opportunity and so on. But, you know, the fact that, you know, Order of Canada, proud Canadian. I mean, probably the proudest Canadian that I know is Paul. And the fact that, you know, he's the one that gave me this opportunity. He gave me this, you know, if it wasn't for him, I never become a Canadian GM to begin with. I don't know how many of us have, I think there's only been 5 or 6 probably total. But he believed in me. And there was a fierce belief in me, even when things weren't going well. And he stuck with me. And he could have easily pulled the cord. And, and he gave me the job young. I was 32. And he could have easily gone outside the organization. And I think back, and you know what? Like, I don't think he did it for charity or anything. I don't think he did it because I was Canadian. But I would think, you know, knowing Paul, that's something he should be proud of as well, that, you know, he he's the reason that a Canadian won the World Series, because he's the one who did it. He had the guts to do it. He had the guts to give me the job and, you know, stick with me even when things weren't going well. So I'm more proud of that as time goes on. And I already was very grateful to him, but I'm more grateful that he put me in that position.
Well, I think you know that we all admire Beeston and love him, and we know him well enough to know why we love him and why he is the kind of person that he is. Do you stay in touch with him on any kind of regular basis?
Oh, have you
over the years?
Yep, I have. I have. We'll talk during the year. You know, it's pretty interesting. So, you know, Paul would talk about Peter Hardy a lot, who was his mentor. Mm-hmm. And he would always quote things. Peter Hardy said this, Peter Hardy said that. Just a way to live your life, a way to do business, a way to do things a certain way. And, you know, it's just hearing the way Paul's talked about him and things that, you know, Peter Hardy struck me as such a wise man, you know, just the wisdom and the way I you know, Paul talks about such reverence. And I wish I would have had a chance to work with him and so on. But obviously, Paul's very successful. And when I look back now and I think about just things, just observing Paul and the way he deals with people and treats people and his just the organizational philosophies in life and bills and so on. And there's, you know, and there's times when I have a, you know, a tough decision I have or philosophical decision, you know, he's someone that I'm curious to know what he thinks, you know, and what, you know, and his perspective in life is so, it's so good, you know. And, you know, beyond the fact he's a successful executive and, you know, an accountant and everything else, he's just, in, you know, as I've gotten older, it's probably like a kid when you look back at your parents and you look back at the things they would talk to you about when you're younger. And as you've gotten older, you start to understand and appreciate more and more and more. So, you know, and I know he was influenced by Peter Hardy as well, but there's times that I'll quote some of the Peter Hardy things and I'll say, when I was doing this, I thought of this, you know. And there's a lot of times I'll think about some of these sayings they had and the quotes they had, and then I'll use it to guide me in some of the decisions that I make, both work-wise and in my life.
What'd you learn in LA then?
You know, I work with, I think, you know, both those guys, Farhan Zaidi and Andrew Friedman, I think those guys are going to end up in the Hall of Fame. They're really, really bright. So, you know, one, I was flattered that they wanted me to come work with them. And at the time, you know, it was 2 years. It went by fast. At the time, I remember saying, I wish I'd gotten another 2 years there. I think 4 years would have been great. And I felt the same way when I got the GM job in Toronto. I had 4 years in assistant GM. I wish I'd had another 4 years, just a little more time. Things always felt a little shorter than they needed to be. But I think for them, I think the way they prepared for each game, the way they prepared for the opponent was eye-opening. I mean, we, you know, all teams prepare, right? You have an advanced process, sure, and so on. But I felt like their process there was, you know, one other. It was it was really elite. And being around that, experiencing that, just seeing how they valued players and seeing the importance of depth. Like anything else, if you're not learning the people you're around, you surround yourself with as many good people as you can, and you'll learn from them. So, but I would say really their daily preparation for the game that night was definitely eye-opening to me. And just how deep they were as an organization. Now, I think depth is what will get you to the playoffs. I think once you're in the playoffs, it's not depth, because you're only using, let's say, four relievers, right? And three starters. And, you know, your lineup is your lineup and so on. Whereas you get through 162 games and you're playing 10 games in a row, 20 games in a row, you need a lot more bodies and so on. So I do think they're not the same thing, but you need to make sure you don't lose sight of being able to get in first. So a lot of those things there. Look, I still talk to the two of those guys as well. They're my two great friends in the game. And, you know, it all worked out in the end. I didn't want to leave Toronto at the time. Obviously, I made that decision. I, you know, that was my choice. Even though I didn't want to, I felt like it was something I needed to do. But in the grand scheme of things, getting a chance to go to LA, getting a chance to come to Atlanta, I mean, who's to say I would have won a World Series if I would have stayed? So, and I think, you know, you look at the way Toronto's set up now, they're in great hands too, in a great position. So, all things happen for a reason. I know some people think it's a cop-out, but I actually believe in it. And I think it worked out on all sides, and career-wise, it's been great change.
Well, as long as we've known each other, maybe a decade or so, things have changed in this game. I don't have to tell you. And I'm wondering, one of the more intriguing things that I wanted to ask you today was, How do you view the value of a starting pitcher today versus even 5 years ago, AA, certainly 10 years ago? And has the value of that starting pitcher essentially decreased or diminished given the limited usage that you now get, even out of a frontline starter?
Yeah, I don't think the value has decreased. I think there's just fewer guys who can do it. And that's a whole other conversation. But look, we love the fact that we had Charlie Morton and Max Fried and Ian Anderson. There was no – I love – if a starter can go seven innings, it's great because now you're only looking at six outs out of your bullpen. So especially during the season. So I know there's a lot of talk about third time through the lineup and so on. And it's real for some of these guys. But if you have quality starters, it's not as big a deal. But, you know, you start looking at getting five innings out of your starter, having a you know, have your bullpen pitch four innings. It's a lot. And the impact the following day and so on. So, look, there's value to the openers. But I think teams are doing that because they don't have alternatives at starters that they like, that they think are good. So we've done it as well. We've tried to avoid it whenever we can, but it made most sense and it gave us the best chance and opportunity to win. We did it. Now, you know, my own opinion on this thing, as I've talked to our players about this too, for the good of the game, the same way now, if you're a reliever, you need to face three guys. I think we should be doing things. Whoever starts a game, you have to line up once, at least nine hitters or something to that effect of, where you can't just go three hitters and you're out or five hitters and you're out. But try to get the value back and place a premium on that. You know, we're still developing starters in the minor leagues and so on, but I just think there's a lot of really bright people in the game, and the longer a guy's out there, obviously the stats against that, the OPS and things like that will get worse. And our relievers now are throwing really hard. Their stuff is really good. And I think clubs are getting really smart about where they're deploying guys, what parts of the lineup. I mean, we'll look at parts of the lineup and say, you know, 5, 6, 7 in the order, this is a great spot for the right-hander we have in the bullpen who has a really good slider. These three hitters are susceptible to right-handed sliders. So, you know, the manager knows that if I can line up my reliever to face these three guys, this is where I'm going to have the most success, you know. And you're just, we've come to the point that we're just trying to game plan for 27 outs. But look, I like the fact that who's starting today, you know, Verlander against Max Scherzer, Zach Greinke against whoever. As long as the rules are in place, we just have to do what we feel is gives us the best chance to win.
With that in mind, how many more years can Morton pitch?
Extended him. I mean, what's incredible, he was hitting 98. He's 37. He was hitting 98 in the playoffs. And, you know, he's one of my favorite players to be around as a human being. He's fantastic. He's a great example for the young guys. So we went out and extended him ahead of time, you know, even though we could have got to the offseason and given him the qualifying offer, that kind of stuff. I just wanted to make sure we had him signed. And we're excited to have him back for 2022. But he takes care of himself. He works hard. I think as long as he's having fun and he enjoys it, I think he'll continue to pitch. But, you know, it's been huge for us to have a guy like that, especially for the young starters.
You know, you mentioned right at the top of the interview that once you got tested positive for COVID, Freddie Freeman called. That just tweaked me to say, well, he's got to be something special. Is he?
He is. So Freddie, you talk to him, he's a guy that likes to FaceTime. So he's the only person other than my wife and kids that that if I contact him, it's not a call. I actually get my phone and I do FaceTime and he answers in his big bright smile, is right in there, you know. And he'll do it sometimes during the season. He'll be in the training room on the training table. I know it's a FaceTime. So when he called twice, he actually FaceTimed me twice. So the first time he FaceTimed me, I'm at home and it's game 5. And I'm like, oh man, I can't have him. Like, he's going to say, what the heck are you doing at home? I didn't answer. I'm like, how am I going to dodge this bullet? You know, text. And then I waited a few minutes. I sent him a text back. Sorry, charging my phone. you know, maybe we were scrambling after the game and this and that. And then he tried to FaceTime me again before game 6. And I didn't answer, but I figured that's when I started really worrying about it. But no, he's someone that, look, obviously he's a great talent, he's a great player. As a GM, he's a partner. he's not someone, he understands as much as he can the role that a GM has bouncing those things. I remember 2018 trade deadline, we want to add. He understands managing short-term, long-term, what you're trying to do. Obviously, he wants to win, but you know, he's offered to help me anytime we're trying to sign a player, recruit a player, or whatever you need to do. I called him trade deadline. I wanted to get his take on some things. We had just gotten back from a road trip, probably 11 at night. I FaceTime him. He's in bed with his son, and he'd just gotten back. I'm like, hey, I'll call you tomorrow. He's like, no. So we probably talked for an hour, and I was just kind of filling him in and just telling him some things we had going and just want to get a sense of clubhouse-wise and so on. I trust his opinion, you know, and I'm not down there every day. He has his finger on the pulse, and, you know, he's smart and he cares. And, you know, I haven't had a player. I mean, he's probably, in terms of just complete, and I like a lot of players I've been around, but he's probably the most complete player I've been around in terms of work ethic, talent, makeup, character, organization, understanding my job. I mean, he literally checks every box. So obviously he's a free agent. We've been clear we want to sign him back. He wants to stay. Like anything, when you have big, great players like that, those are normally big deals and they take time. But I'm really grateful that, you know, I didn't know him before I got here. I knew he was a great player. Getting to know him for 4 years, I've been to his house before. You know, he's as great as you see on TV with the interviews and everything else. He's every bit as good as that, if not more.
So you extended him a qualifying offer, but you intend to sign him long-term.
Yeah, the qualifying offer is just a formality.
No, I get that, Abe. I think it's important, though, to
tell Clayton Kershaw that today.
Well, there's one. Like, are you at all shocked by that?
You know what? It's impossible. You know, you just don't know. Obviously, I was in L.A. with Clayton, and he's another, you know, career Dodger and so on. It's impossible to know what goes into those decisions and so on. I know Clayton obviously got hurt at the end of the year and wasn't available. You know, you look at L.A., and I'm happy he won, but they lost a lot of players. May, Bauer, Kershaw, Max Muncy, Turner. I mean, they still won 106 games. So, but – you know what? I'm not really surprised by anything in this game anymore. You just don't know what's going on with every organization, with every team and things like that. So I think, you know, the great players that have been with one organization, you normally expect that relationship to continue. That's just the way the game's gone. There's not too many of them, but you look at the Cardinals with Molina, Wainwright and so on. It's great, you know, when you have players that can spend, you know, the whole career with one club. And when it comes to Freddie and us, I know that that's important to him. You know, he's going to be a Hall of Famer and he's going to go in a Brave, and it would be great that he plays his entire career, obviously, with one club. He means a lot to the fans, the city, the organization, and the city and the organization means a lot to him, too. He really cares.
Well, I'm just wondering specifically, do you extend, let's take Freddie as an example, do you extend Freddie to protect the organization? Because then you're eligible for draft picks. If you don't protect him, you're not, and he leaves. Or is a lot of that a sign of respect to the individual player?
No, I think it's to protect the organization. You know, I think, okay. So, your goal is to still sign these guys and so on, but, you know, you still have protected, you know, and you see all these other great players that all got qualifying offers, that all elite talents and so on. So I don't want to speak for the other teams, but, you know, we do it obviously to protect the organization just as a matter of course. But obviously, look, a guy like Freddie, he's the best first baseman in the game. And, you know, we certainly feel that way about him, and we're going to certainly do everything we can to try to have him sign.
John, you have something else?
Well, the one person we haven't talked about is the person who, in many ways, and I'm not a baseball guy truly, but the antithesis of what I see with you, Alex, and that's Brian Snitker. I mean, how is that relationship? And obviously it's been successful and you have a great ability to communicate.
Yeah, so I didn't know him at all. I remember I got the job. He came out to the press conference here, and you know, he was in the last year of his deal. And, you know, but the one thing is there's not a political bone in his body. He is who he is. He's genuine. He's sincere. You know, the manager-GM relationship is really important. Obviously, he needs to do his job and manage a clubhouse and, you know, make the in-game moves and things like that. But there needs to be trust on both sides, and I think there needs to be a level of respect on both sides. And I think like anything over time, I think I've learned to appreciate and understand and respect his role. I think he does a great job of understanding and respecting my role. And there's going to be a give and take. And, you know, Paul Beeston always joke about check the org chart. You know, whenever we may not be agreeing on something, he'd say, Addison, you should check the org chart on that. You know, and, you know, I've never, you know, he laughs, of course, and, you know, and he'd say things like that. But I could always obviously just buy it with the organizational chart. Sure. Could I pull rank on certain things? Sure. It's not the way you want to do things, right? You have to view it as a partnership at the end of the day. So if there are times that he feels really strongly about something, and I might feel strongly as well, but if he feels really strongly, I'm going to go with him. And I think the same way, if I feel really strongly about something, he's going to end up going with me. So I think it's just there's a healthy give and take and respect level. And at the end of the day, we can talk about putting the roster together and so on, but it comes down to who are you going to use? You know, and I'll ask him, I might think we should have so-and-so and so-and-so, but if you're not going to use this person and you don't trust the player in these roles, we shouldn't put them on the roster no matter what I think, you know? And, you know, and I also remind him too, that, you know, as much as we, you know, prepare and give information and so on, I always remind him, I said, look, as much as in the moment you're managing the game, you have to adjust and so on. But I would say that you're the guy with the microphones in front of your face at the end of the game. I'm hanging out in my office. I don't have to do any of that stuff. I don't have to deal with the bullets and everything else. So I always tell him, if you're ever not sure and you're, you know, as much as you prepare for an exam, you still have to put your head on the pillow and make the decisions you feel are best. And that's why he's in that position. So you're the one who has to face the media after. You have to face the players after. You have to deal with the clubhouse and all those things. So I always try to remind him of that, whatever decisions you make, you know, feel good about it, you know, and it right, wrong, or indifferent, at least if your process is sound, you felt like there were decisions you wanted to make, forget what the data says and the R&D department, analytics and so on, because you're the one who has to stand up there and answer all the questions and deal with the clubhouse and everything else. So I think it's worked well. And obviously we've had a ton of success together, 4 years, four NL East in a row. Yeah. And he's got a humility to get better. You know, he knows, he's like, you know, he's not an analytical guy, an R&D guy, but he takes the information, he'll use it when he can. And we've had great success.
That's the understatement of the day, Alex, when you win the World Series and you say, I think it's working well.
Listen, we want to let you go. Time is kind of our enemy here. Are you going to make it home for Christmas or over the next little while?
Yep. My in-laws live up in Innisfil. A lot of my wife's side of the family, they're up there. So we get back in the summer and during Christmas. And then also around Christmas Day or the 26th, we head up to Montreal, spend time with my side. And then sometime after New Year's, we'll get back to Atlanta and get ready for spring.
Fantastic.
Well, listen, you know, you have our congratulations. We couldn't be happier for you. You're always gracious with your time. When you have a great off season, and congrats on a World Series. Good for you.
Very, very much. See you guys.
Alex Anthopoulos. We'll come back with more after this. Well, as usual, our thanks to Alex Anthopoulos for carrying the show for us.
We made a mistake, Bob. We made a mistake.
Well, I should have booked him for
three shows. We could do Alex Anthopoulos week. I mean, there are, because he's just so giving of his time is one thing, but opinions and stories is another. I mean, it's just fantastic. And here's the other thing. So, you know, baseball, we point the finger at baseball more than any other sport about analytics. And you've always pointed the finger at, you know, they're destroying starting pitchers. And here's Alex comes on and talks about how important culture is, that he wants to get back to having good starting pitching.
That's what I took from it. I took from it that he agrees with me that the way the game is being played today, he's trying to suggest it's not as deliberate as I believe it is. Because I believe this is a deliberate change in the way the baseball infrastructure looks at the
because they can't find them. Because they can't find it.
I don't agree, John.
Well, that's what he says.
Well, he can say that, but I don't agree with him. Mm. I think there's no reason to believe there are fewer starting pitchers today in systems than there were before. What has changed is how they are used. And when you do that, you necessitate other change. If you're only going to have pitchers pitch five or six innings, then you're going to have different, stronger, and more bullpen help. And so what has been sacrificed here are bats off the bench.
Yes.
At least one, and in many cases, two bats off the bench. And so it becomes a, you know, self-repeating prophecy, essentially, that if you're going to use your starters this way, then everything else has to change. And I think he understands that. But I think if you really got him, you know, if you sat him down at a bar quietly with a beer in his hand, I think he'd honestly tell you he wishes it was like it was. he tends to believe. And I thought the idea of making a starting pitcher face nine pitchers is really interesting. Of course, you can't do it.
Nine hitters.
Yeah. Of course, you can't do it.
No.
Because, you know, guy gets you know, six bombs hit off him in the first six hitters. You can't force him to stay out there.
You want the games to try to remain competitive, right?
Well, of course.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting thought. Yeah. It's a really, really interesting thought.
Hey, we had a good talker today. We got a good talker tomorrow, man. We got a good talker tomorrow.
What are we doing tomorrow?
John Herdman.
Oh, the footy guy.
Yeah.
Stay tuned for that.
Getting ready for his two games in Edmonton in the next week.
So. Coming up. We got to get out of here. Our thanks for watching or listening. Our thanks to Alex Anthopoulos again. For John Shannon, Bob McCowan. Goodbye, everybody.